Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2012. Lecture 20, delivered on November 5, 2012. The title of this lecture is Debt and Debt Instruments.
Today, Debt and Debt Instruments. I want to begin this with a really quick question, and it probably has a nuanced answer. But I'll give it a try anyway, see if anyone gives me the answer that I want. I don't know. Madam, would you like to be wealthy? Would you like to make a lot of money? Live well? Age gracefully? Purchase cougar bait in your old age? I can see some here in the front row. Quality cougar bait. Gentlemen. Actually, I can tell you how to do that a couple of different ways. I can actually tell you how you can become wealthy, how you could even engage in your own enterprise and make a lot of money. On the downside, you could actually take an ass bath, okay? But there you go. Risk and return, you know, that whole relationship there. As I've told you before, and I think I've shown you an example of this previously in the class, but I want to focus down on it now, is the key to making a lot of money, one of the keys is to do the old OPM strategy. Now, do you remember what OPM is? Other people's money, okay? Always, always use other people's money. This is part of a larger rule. Put other people at risk and leave yourself room to run, okay? It was the way I lived through the military and all that, you know. And the thing about it is, interestingly enough, when you are putting other people at risk, transferring risk away from yourself, the trick is not to transfer the bulk of the gain away from yourself. That's the hard part, because most people bitch if they're taking the risk and you're taking all of the reward for it. But, you know, that's how life is. And as I said, I've given you an example of this before, but I want to give you a full comprehensive understanding of what's going on here. Now, you have decided that it's time for you to own your first home. A very nice double-wide trailer, okay? But you have to think about what you're going to do, how you're going to pay for this. Now, obviously, you have a friend here who wants to live in the mobile home park with you so that you can live the good life together. Okay, so you want to buy a mobile home too. Now, you're going to buy, each of you is going to buy one for $100,000. Now, you don't plan to stay there for very long. For 1 year. But you know that these will appreciate. They sell like hotcakes. So in a year, the mobile home will be worth $110,000. So you can sell it in 1 year for $110,000. You are a frugal person. You grew up never a borrower nor a lender be. So you're going to finance this with your own money. $100,000, you're just going to buy it with your own equity. So we're going to have the equity component for you, you're going to put $100,000 out of your pocket. And so that means that you are going to borrow nothing. You are going to finance 90% of the home with a loan. So you're going to put in $10,000 of your own money. Now you're borrowing this money, and we're going to say that you're going to borrow this at 6%. This money. So in a year, you're going to have to pay off your $90,000 and 6% of $90,000, which is $5,600. Okay? So let's go to the end story here. In 1 year, both of you sell your home. Now, the sale, your payoff on debt for you is going to be zero. $0 principal and $0 interest. So you will gain $100,000 minus $10,000. Your dollar gain will be $10,000. You have to pay off your loan to the bank, which was $90,000, principal, and you're going to have to pay off $5,600 in interest. So the total that you'll be paying off is $95,600. So your gain on your investment is $110,000 minus the $95,600, okay? And obviously minus your initial investment, minus your initial investment of $10,000. So your final gain at the end of the day would be $100,000 would be $4,400. $4,400. So now, in a very friendly manner, you point to her and say, "Ha ha, I've got more money than you do." And you say, "Bite me, you cow. Look what happened." You, return on equity. You put in $10,000. You put in $100,000. You gained $10,000. So your ROE is 10%. That's yours. Yours. You put in $10,000, you gain $4,400, your return is 44%. Spank me, Jesus. That's what we call the gains to leverage. The gains to leverage. Your ROE is staggering compared to hers. Now, suppose you'd had $100,000. You could have done that with 10 different homes, and at the end of the day, you would have come out with $44,000 on $100,000. She came up with $10,000 on $100,000. That is the power of debt. Debt magnifies gains. Unfortunately, it also magnifies losses. That's why I say you can become wealthy this way, or you can take a butt bath this way. Here's the fact of the matter is that I don't know if they do this much anymore, but there was a whole thing for years about creative financing. They'd have these infomercials, I made myself a millionaire buying and selling homes. This was how they did it. And yes, it was done. It worked until the housing market crashed. And then, well, there you go. But at the same time, if you're smart and you know when to get out from under this kind of a routine, yes, you can become very wealthy very fast using OPM, other people's money. Borrowing, and the more you do this, the more that you show that you're credit worthy, the more you can get lenders to let you play this game. This is part of a larger issue, not just for persons, but for corporations, is that debt has the danger that you can go into, you can get to a point where you don't have enough EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, operating income, to pay your interest. Then it's over. Your corporation is in default, bankruptcy, the whole nine yards. But as long as you are prudent with your debt, using debt in your capital structure with equity magnifies your return to the equity. The farther you go with this, if I had said, let's try you using $5,000, you would have seen that the return to equity magnified more. Essentially, by taking on debt in the capital structure, you are indeed going to magnify the return to the shareholders. That is pursuant to the goal of the corporation, which is to maximize shareholder wealth. That is the goal of a corporation. There is no, well, we have to look at all of our stakeholders and maximize all the, no, your job is to maximize your shareholders' wealth, simply because the shareholders are the ones who can fire your ass. You cannot have all these other stakeholders you hear about in some of these new age courses do anything to you like your shareholders can. They can get rid of the management if the management is not doing the best it can to enhance their return. But again, remember that as you take on more debt, you are getting into more risk, that you are not going to be able to hit your EBIT that pays your interest. In other words, you've got to keep times interest earned above one. And you've got to make sure that you have a risk pad so that if there's fluctuations in sales, you can still pay off your debt. And that's where the next trick comes in. There was a secret in here. You notice that they borrowed, the money was borrowed at 6%, and the gain, the rise in the price of the asset was 10%. That's important because you'll have to make sure that the asset gain is going to always exceed the cost of the debt. That's where the next problem comes in. As you saw in the marginal cost of capital problem, as you take on more debt, your lenders are going to expect more, a higher interest rate. It can get to the point where the interest rate that they ask is higher than what you could possibly achieve with projects that aren't insanely risky. So there's the other side of the story there too, is that you're going to always have to make sure that if you are using OPM, that you're using debt, that you are going to be able to get projects that have a good chance of exceeding that, that cost of the debt. And that's where I come back to that one thing. Remember I was telling you about the different decision-making frameworks and companies? Net present value is the most theoretically sound way, but you still get a lot of corporations that use hurdle rate. Now, and as I said, a lot of times no one knows exactly why they choose the hurdle rate they do, but internally, the decision makers oftentimes base a hurdle rate on the marginal cost of capital. Essentially, they say, all right, what's the worst that our debt's going to cost us in our capital structure? Oh, it's going to possibly maybe hit 12%. Okay, we're going to have to set a hurdle rate above 12% then, just to make sure that we can always return on the investment more than we are going to pay for the money that we borrow. So in this case, I would have been willing to use this trick here because the asset I projected to grow at 10% and the debt, the marginal cost of debt would have stayed at 6%. So that's why that trick works. This takes us to the issue again of capital structure. Companies use a combination of debt and equity. And sometimes you think, well, there's no rhyme or reason. This company uses 40% debt, 60% equity. This company over here uses 20% debt, 80% equity. There are some companies that absolutely refuse to use debt. They just don't do it. It's a corporate philosophy. It's one that we consider to be misguided, but, I mean, successful corporations stay the hell away from debt. They say, we're not going to do it. We're never going to put our shareholders in any chance at all of losing their equity stake. The only way we can make a zero probability of that is to have no debt ever. So there you go. You have some companies that basically will take on lots of debt. You'll have some companies that take on only a little bit of debt. And I will go one more time with this. With the percentage of debt in the capital structure, it can go from 0% up to a pure debt company, 100%. And if you use zero debt, then you're using 100% equity. So your cost of capital, your weighted average cost of capital, would be the cost of equity, case of S. And then as you take on debt, which is cheaper than equity, that weighted average cost of capital begins to fall. And ultimately, if you were 100% debt, then your weighted average cost of capital, the weight of debt would be 100%, weight of equity would be zero, so you would have the after-tax cost of debt being the total cost. The problem is that that's theoretical. And as I had mentioned before, two financial economists, Modigliani and Miller, said, well, why don't we see all companies 100% debt if debt is cheaper than equity? And the answer was simply this, because ultimately there's some point where, yeah, even though it is true at first that debt is cheaper than equity, there comes a point where the company becomes so risky that debt begins to get stupidly expensive. 100% firm has very high cost of debt, insanely high cost of debt, because it's almost a sure thing that the company's going to go bankrupt. So the whole idea for corporations is to identify this sweet spot, this lowest point, the optimal weighted average cost of capital, the minimum weighted average cost of capital. And we call this place, the combination of debt and equity that does that, we call that the optimal capital structure. The optimal capital structure. Like I said, companies, it's all over the place. You'll see companies where the optimal capital structure is 20% debt, 80% equity. They'll say that. Other companies will say it's 90% debt, 10% equity. They've done internal calculations and combined them with oftentimes corporate philosophy to come up with the number that they use. Like you saw in that marginal cost of capital problem. I just said, well, this company used 40% debt, 60% equity. You probably, even as a finance person in a company, would not for a long time be involved in deciding this. But as I told you before, and I think I mentioned this, oftentimes companies will actually issue stock or issue bonds just because they are away from their optimal capital structure point. They will find that over time, for example, they will borrow money out to, let's say, this is 60% debt, 40% equity. They will have borrowed money to the point where they are at 70% debt, 30% equity. They'll simply issue stock and pay off bonds just to drive themselves back down to what they think is their optimal capital structure. They'll do it the other way too. Sometimes a company will have so much of an equity buildup that it will pull away from optimal capital structure. So what it will they'll do is they will simply just borrow money just for the purpose of bringing themselves back down to that low point they think is their low point for their weighted average cost of capital. So now that takes us to one of the last parts of this course is where we talk about the actual instruments of financing. And we begin with debt. Because clearly, debt has the power to magnify return on equity. And if we are doing what is in our shareholders' interest, our shareholders, we have to maximize their wealth. That's our job. And if we are to maximize their wealth, and we know that using debt does magnify return on equity, then it would become almost necessary as part of our fiduciary duty to include debt, but not so much that we created too much risk for the shareholders. So we have debt. And we go through the story of debt now. And I've already done part of this, and it's just a reminder so that I can ask you again on the second exam. Short debt, less than 1 year, is called a bill. Companies get bills all the time. But actually, the company issued the bill, and then they're just having to satisfy the bill they issued. It's short-term debt that is issued. And then 1 to 7 years, we call those notes. And then more than 7 years, we call those bonds. Now, interestingly enough, bills, the short debt, is all kinds of, there's a deep composition to it. Companies get bills of all kinds, create bills of all kinds. You know, your utility bills, the bills you owe to your employers, to your suppliers. So in the debt portion of a balance sheet, you would be looking at the current liabilities. Things like accounts payable, you would look at the relatively short-term taxes that you have deferred paying. Even to a certain extent, you declare a dividend, but you don't pay it right away. So there's an accumulation of a short-term debt there. There's all kinds of different debts that a company has that are very short-term, just like you have debts that are short-term. You get a bill, you put it off for a couple of days. Who am I kidding? I put it off for a couple of years. Now, you get all kinds of different bills. So there is composition, there's structure inside of the short-term debt. Now, as far as corporations go, some of this is just routine, necessary. Well, we're going to have a bill for our utilities. We're going to have a bill for this or that. Others of this is structured debt, short structured debt. One of the most common kinds among large corporations is a kind of short debt, and I've mentioned it before, called commercial paper. Commercial paper is issued by large creditworthy corporations, about 30 days in duration, and it's essentially a way for investors to lend money and get it back very quickly with a little bit of return on it. And it's very safe. Unfortunately, once in a great while, you have a corporation that's right at the edge of dying, and it'll pump out commercial paper, and everyone's sucker, and it's just that nice big corporation. We'll buy some of that paper, $50 million worth of paper. That's kind of a lot, but yeah, sure. And then you'll find out that all the corporation was doing was trying to buy itself a few last weeks before it died. It happens. WorldCom, Enron did this. And so it kind of shakes the market, but it's still, for the most part, when you become filthy rich, you'll use commercial paper. It's nice, clean stuff, and it's very short-term. So if you're talking about structured short-term debt, you would probably say commercial paper is the classic example of it. In government, the classic example is treasury bills, T-bills. And I honestly don't know it. I don't think agency debt ever is that short. Maybe it is, but I'm not familiar with that market. So in the corporate world, it's commercial paper. In government, quick money to deal with bills would be treasury bills. They can be anywhere from 90 days on up to a year, the T-bills are. Very safe. They're not going to, you're not going to ever have the government default. The unfortunate part about T-bills right now is that the amount of money that you get on them, it sucks. In fact, there are some days, and I know this from some corporate finance people who use T-bills in the balance of their portfolio with their cash. This one woman, she actually contacted me. She was a former student of mine. She said, "I'm going crazy. I've been working all day to find some treasury bills. We finally found some, and I ran the numbers, and I got a negative interest rate." She said, "What am I doing wrong?" I said, "You're doing nothing wrong. T-bills are actually yielding slightly negative sometimes right now." I mean, that's pretty weird. You're actually paying the government to lend it money. And by the way, that can't last forever. God knows how it's lasted as long as it has, but it'll come to an end and we'll be sorry for what we've been doing. But okay, that's enough of that. Now, in personal, you get your regular bills every month that are less than 1 year in duration. When you use electricity, you're essentially issuing a bill to the electric company, and the company sends you a notice that your bill is due, and it's your bill. You issued it, even though they printed it up to send to you. Are there any more structured examples of short-term debt, real short, that are structured, that are personal? Well, there's one. That's actually, it doesn't seem like it, but it's credit cards are that way. Credit cards are essentially a short-term debt, but you don't ever have to pay them off. As a matter of fact, if you make the minimum payment on most credit cards with high balances, you would pay it off in probably 50 years. So just ride it out, and you'll eventually die, and you'll screw them. Again, an imbalance that probably will fix itself. Okay, notes. Now, the government issues notes quite a bit. And as a matter of fact, I showed you an example of a note, the Federal Reserve note, that is that we call money, currency. But as far as corporate goes, all kinds of notes out there, just intermediate term borrowings. Remember what I told you, when you're calculating debt ratios, always remember to include not just your bonds, which are listed in long-term liabilities, but also to go back and look at your notes payable. Because some companies prefer to keep themselves a little bit tighter on the duration of their debt portfolio, so they'll pull back and they'll do a lot more that's intermediate. In personal, one of the classic examples of notes that you would pay, that you would issue, would be for buying a car. Almost all of you will eventually buy some kind of a car, probably something ugly ass, but you'll buy it because you'll think it's cool, and then you will have issued a note. That's the classic one. There are a few other notes too out there. Can you think of one that's also out there that's probably a note? It could be a bond, but oftentimes it's a note that you are issuing. Can you think of one? Car is obvious. Is there any other? Your student loans. Many of those don't have many years duration. That some of them border between a bond and a note, but some of them are most decidedly in the note category. I've got a parent loan sticking out in my face, up my ass and everything. I have to have that thing done in 5 years. I issued a note. I didn't want to, but I did. And so some of your student loans, anything that will, you'll have to get finished up in less than 7 years, that's a note that you issue. Okay. And there are different classes of notes, too. But as I said, the government issues them. Corporations issue them. Just keep an eye out for notes payable. Now we get to the biggie, the bonds. Governments issue bonds, people issue bonds, and corporations issue lots and lots of bonds. In a given year, new issue of bonds can be in the hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars. It's just massive. Corporations issue the bonds as their primary debt instrument. And there are all manner of them out there. Corporate and government bonds are different from our bonds that we issue, like for a home, because when we issue bonds, when we have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, as we make payments, we're actually paying off part of the principal and the interest due all at the same time. With corporate and government bonds, all you ever do is pay off the interest until the end. And at the end, you make one last interest payment, and then you pay off the original face value of the debt. Most of these bonds, I don't think there's any that don't, have some kind of a provision. The bond holders, the buyers of the bonds, the lenders, require that the corporation manage and maintain a sinking fund where they are putting money in every year, every quarter, whatever, so that when the bond is matured, they have the money in the bank to pay off the face value. So basically, there's amortization going on anyway. Let's get up to the top here. The highest quality bonds would be of all of them. There are simply bonds, and then there are callable bonds, and there are convertible bonds. Now, a bond is, if it doesn't say callable or convertible, it ain't. But you got to watch it. If you get a callable bond is a bond that gives the company the right to pay off the bond before the date of maturity. So in other words, if a company issued a bond, let's say we had a bond IZX 8.5 32. IZX 8.5 32. And I'm trying to get reformed because the quote looks different, and you've seen me write it a different way. They're not done the way I used to do them, but okay, one way or the other. Okay, IZX 8.5 32. This means that this bond will mature in the year 2032. The company will pay $1,000 to the holder of the bond. Before that date, every year, in half-year increments, it will pay 8.5% of $1,000, which means that every year, in two separate payments, it will pay the holder $85. It will service the debt. If all you're doing is paying the interest, that is debt service. It's servicing the debt. And then in the year 2032, on the due date, it will make one last payment, and then it will also pay off the bond. And remember that bonds pay, this would actually, every year $85 means that in reality, every 6 months, it would pay $42.50. Okay, now, if it is a regular bond, the buyers buy the bonds, in other words, lend the company the $1,000, and then they just sit there and collect their $85 checks every year. And then at the end, in 2032, they get one last $85 check, and they get their $1,000 back, their principal. However, if it is a callable bond, the company can pay it off early. Let's say that this was an appropriate risk-adjusted rate in 2012. But by the time we get to, let's say, 2020, bonds like this would have been paying 7.2%. The company, if it is a callable bond, can say, all right, we are going to pay you off early. Here's your $1,000 back. Have a good day and bite me. And then they will reborrow at this obviously lower rate. It's just a pure refi. Now you can imagine how excited the investors are about that, because they were expecting to get 8.5% until the year 2032. And here they are. They've just been handed their asses back. And now they have that $1,000. They've got to go out and reinvest it. Well, the interest rate environment is lower now, so they're going to be reinvesting at 7.2%. For the investors, for the lenders, for the buyers of the bonds, a callable bond is less desirable. That means that the borrowers are going to punish the company a little bit on the price of these bonds. That's just the way it is. Usually the way it works is that when you've got a callable bond, the negotiation works something like this. All right, you are our lenders. You're going to lend us money. We want to have a call provision so that we can pay you off early. So the lenders say, all right, you want a callable bond. You understand that we're going to punish you for a callable bond. You do understand that. We're not going to give you $1,000 for each of these bonds, lend you. We might shave something off there because we're giving you a right to do something that's adverse to us. The second thing is they're going to say, all right, your call provision, you can't use it right away. We're going to say that only after, let's say, 2020 can you actually do the call. So we will expect that in 2020 you're going to call on us, but we're going to postpone that so that you can't do it too soon. So usually callable bonds have a point where basically the company then has the right to call. Before that, the company doesn't have the right. So callable bonds will have that covenant, that provision in them that delays the time when they can be called. Now, the next one that is a dirty dog is the convertible bond. The convertible bond gives the corporation the right to convert the debt into equity. So you're a lender. I've lent this company money. I'm expecting to get my coupons, and I'm expecting to get my $1,000 back in 2032. And suddenly, that's a convertible bond, and the company just exercised conversion? Well, conversion in this case doesn't mean that you suddenly take on a new religion, although that can be part of it when you start invoking the names of various gods when they do it. But what it does is it gives the company the right to turn your debt, what that company owes me, into stock in the company. Now, why would I be very upset when a company turned its debt into equity? Remember, equity is forever. What would be so bad about that? I lent you money, and suddenly you send me a notice saying, I no longer owe you money, you own a piece of my ass. Huh? Yeah, absolutely. If I want to get out, if I can't afford my interest payments, if I am in so much trouble, I would just love it if I could turn those debt holders into shareholders. Because remember debt holders, all the horrible things that they can do to you? Remember I told you about that? They can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mama wear furry costumes to please them? Shareholders can't do that. So you could turn me into a toothless complainer. I could no longer take you to court because you hadn't paid me my interest payments. I could no longer take you to court because you couldn't pay me my principal. I just become a shareholder who has to go to your annual shareholders meetings and whine and bitch at you. That's the bad thing about convertible debt. It is nasty, nasty as hell. It's just not very good. Companies that are high risk will do this. But I will tell you right now, convertible bonds usually are discounted heavily from par, even when they're at issue, because of this problem with the conversion in them, the possibility. Why would you even think of having a convertible bond? You're already expecting that you're going to get your butts kicked out there in the market? That's not a good sign to begin. Okay? And I want to mention one other thing here, too. And this actually crosses the bridge. All three of these can be this way. All three of these can be this way. But I want to focus on one particularly. There is a kind of bond called a discount bond. All it means is that the bond sells at a deep discount to par, no interest is paid, but then at the end, $1,000 is paid back. Now, discount T-bills are discount instruments, just by their nature. So you buy a T-bill for $980. You get $1,000 back in exactly 1 year, so you collect $20 on it. So your yield is $20 over your investment of $980. Don't even ask me what that is. Okay, 20 divided by 980. It's 2.04%. And they call them discount because they are just sold at a discount to par, and then you make your interest on the spread between the price you paid for it, how much you lent, and how much you get back. So if you said, I need to borrow some money, and I said, okay, how much do you need? $1,000. Well, how much are you going to pay me? How long is it going to take you? 1 year. Okay, here's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to lend you $950. You pay me $1,000 back in a year. Can you live with that? Well, no, I need $1,000. Okay, we'll just rearrange it. You give me, I'll give you $1,000 now, but you have to pay me back $1,060 in 1 year. So that discount feature is there. The spread is my interest on it. Okay, you're not paying interest along the way. You just pay it at the end. Now, interestingly enough, though, commercial paper is that way. Commercial paper is that way. I mean, basically, a lot of instruments that are less than a year in duration are nothing but discount instruments. A certain amount is lent, and then a larger amount is paid back, and the spread is the interest. There's not like a coupon or an amortization or anything like that. Where you get into the interesting story is in notes and bonds, because basically, if you see something that is a discount instrument, that is a note or a bond in terms of how long it's out there, you're talking about something that is what we politely call not investment grade. A more generic term would say you're talking about a clear example of a junk bond. I mean, on the street, what you would, an even more technical term would be, oh, that's shit. Because basically what you've got is a corporation. It is going to issue a deep discount bond. Let's try one. A ZCB, that's a zero coupon bond, a ZCB. Price $480. face 1,000. Term 7 years. In other words, Mr. Lender, you lend me $480 now, and in 7 years, I won't talk to you until 7 years from now. In 7 years, you're just going to get $1,000. These are called ZCBs, zero coupon bonds. They were very popular in the big era of the junk bond frenzy. The logic of them was that there would be corporations that would require more than a few years to get on their feet, to start generating revenue. To start generating substantial revenue, to get their markets in order, to get their R&D done, get their patents, whatever. And so during that time, they could not afford to make interest payments. But 7 years from now, they'll be in plenty fine shape to be able to pay off the $1,000 to these investors. That was the logic, the theory of these junk bonds, with masters like Michael Milken and people like that in the 90s pulling these. The problem was that, of course, well, there were a couple of problems, and I'll get into that in a minute. But let's look at how you would calculate the yield on one of these. Essentially, you are saying that your return on this, your interest payment would be $550. That would be your interest on it, would be $550. Now, your, just like I did over there, your yield, except that it's a 7-year yield, would be just like any other one. The interest you earn over the investment you made. That's always how you'd get a yield. Interest you earn over investment you made. See how I did it over there? Interest earned over investment made. Interest earned over investment made. That's how you always get a yield. Okay? But the problem here is that I've been pulling a kind of a trick on you all along in this course by using exactly 1-year instruments so that the yield that came out was a 1-year yield. What happens if this is happening over 7 years? How do you fix, how do you do this thing right here? Well, there's your problem, is because basically you're going to have to pull a trick here. In order to get a 1-year yield on this, what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to take this number right here. How I would have gotten a 1-year yield, add 1 to it, and then raise it to the 1/7th power, and then subtract the 1 back off. Yeah, I know. Duh. Yeah. That's how you do it. Yeah. Oh, I'm just testing your ass. My God. 20. 20. God. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Don't get to be my age. Just kill yourself. It'll save your family embarrassment. Save you the cost of diapers, for God's sake. God. No one. Oh, my God. I've probably destroyed more companies with bad arithmetic. Okay, let me do this one. Now that you have fully embarrassed me in front of everyone, thank you very much. 520 divided by 480 plus 1 equals. Now I'm going to raise that to the 1/7th power. And then I'm going to subtract 1. As a percentage, that comes out to be 11.04. 4 or 05%. Let me check that here. 05%. 11.05%. It's just, all you do is you do it like it's a 1-year yield. Just the same thing. Interest earned over amount invested. But in this case, add one and then take that whole wad and raise it to the one over the number of years. And then don't forget to subtract one back off at the end. Don't forget that one. I've forgotten that so many times and I've gotten the wrong answer. Okay, that is a junk yield. And you'll find that that one's actually pretty tame compared to the ones you saw in the back in the day. Now, these are still out there. There are ZCBs still issued to this day. There's nothing unlawful about them. You have to disclose a lot, and you have to make sure that you've got investors who fully understand the implications of investing in a zero coupon instrument. But they're still out there. Generally, not investment grade, and they generally have very high yields just because they're such risky instruments. But they're out there, and they... Just as a little bit of background, a little bit of insight. The markets were just going crazy up in the 1990s. It was considered probably the best time in modern economic history for the country. Unemployment was stupidly low. The stock market just kept going up and up. And because there were so many jobs, there was such great economic activity, and the stock markets were rising so rapidly, tax revenues to the government were really strong. And business tax revenues were strong because there were good incomes, lots of jobs, and capital gains were being realized just like hand over fist. The markets were doing great. And it was just quite a time. And then also businesses were able to plan because they knew that there was a stability of the tax rate system. Taxes were much higher then than they were when Bush came in and cut taxes back about 11 years ago. But the point was that there was a balance between the Senate and House and the presidency so that no one was really moving the tax rates around. And that gave businesses this deep ability to have long planning horizons. We weren't sweating, well, what the hell do we do about this or that? This tax rate might go up that. No, we all knew, had a lot more certainty. And like I said, unemployment was stupidly low, and everything was going great. And in an environment like that, where there's such a lush business ecology, if you will, ecosystem, you would see a lot of variety of companies. This was the era when the software companies just started going wild. Computer manufacturers, consumer products were just getting just great. And you had, in an environment like that, you had a lot more willingness to take risk. And so we had a phenomenon that came derisively to be known as the dot-com boom. The dot-coms were companies that were highly speculative, reaching into new ways to probe and market and earn money off the internet, and in all of its different varieties, business to business, business to consumer, even consumer to consumer. It was just a massively experimental era. And so you had these highly speculative companies. No one knew what the hell the internet was going to be. Really, in the 1990s. It could be anything we wanted, from a venue for porn to a method. Literally, there's a movie out there that shows the birth of the porn industry. These couple of kids your age just started scanning pictures from magazines and posting them on the internet. They became filthy rich millionaires. But at the same time, there was also this understanding that we could begin to manage our businesses, sell products, yeah, on the internet, but also to be able to control inventory, to be able to manage workflow of projects through this incredible thing. Dot-coms were out there, highly speculative, and they were quite upfront. We're not going to earn any money for a while. We don't even know what the hell we're facing. And they needed money. They needed money for rack servers. They needed money for trunk lines. They needed money for personnel, for buildings, for marketing. They needed money. And, of course, you had the old stodgy banking world that said, you, what is this thing, the internet of which you speak? Right? Honestly, it was like that. And so you had the birth of these high-powered cats like Michael Milken. They said, here's a market, we're going to play it. Where you guys need money, we'll find a way to do it. Now, whether or not they were evildoers like they've been portrayed, I'll leave that to you to decide. But the whole idea was to find ways that those companies that were not, they might not even make it, because like I said, we didn't know what the hell the internet was going to be, but we did know that it was going to be something awesome. And we knew these companies couldn't get money from traditional financing sources. So you put those together, and the era of the junk bonds was born. And one of the junk bond favorites was the ZCBs. The dot-coms could get money right now, and they wouldn't have to sweat it until well out there somewhere. Okay? That's where it all started. And of course, unfortunately, in came Darth Vader, otherwise known as Alan Greenspan. He was so pissed off that the market just kept going up and up and up. He had declared in 1996 that it was irrational exuberance. The stock market is being irrational. And he was hell-bent to stop it. So he instituted a series of the longest successive chain of increases in the discount rate, clamped down the money supply. He was convinced that it was all inflation. It wasn't. But he clamped it down. Interest rates tried to stay down. He just couldn't kill it. It was like some guy on crack. You put five bullets in him, the son of a bitch is still laughing at you. And so we got to this point where what basically happened was that you had the most interest rate sensitive, fragile parts of the economy just basically snap. Under this pressure that was being created by the Federal Reserve. They just went pop, pop. The rest of it was saying like that. But these fragile things like dot-coms and other high speculation companies just folded up shop. Game over. And so the ZCBs and the other junk just started defaulting right and left. And so the mythical era of the evildoers and all the horrors that they had done came about. That was what happened. It's for you to decide whether or not, really, at the end of the day, it was as evil as we think, as you might have heard. But that's all I have for you. Thank you.